This is le podcast on emerging leadership. I am Alexis Morville. Over the last years, people have moved from innovating in secret labs to innovating in the open. And open source became the way to define industry standards. Today, I have the great pleasure to have Joseph Jax on the podcast to explore the open source world. Joseph is the founder and general partner of OSS Capital, a fund that exclusively focuses on early stage commercial open source companies. Hey, Joseph, how would you describe your role to someone you just met?
Well, I invest in entrepreneurs building companies around open source technology. And if you don't understand or if you've never heard of open source, it's basically a way of licensing a piece of software, a piece of technology in a way that anyone can use or download or modify or really participate in the commercial opportunities around that technology. And so it kind of gives you this permissionless dynamic. A lot of people think of that as free to use, free to modify. But that's essentially what I do.
Interesting. So investing in, so how does it work? Are you doing that by yourself?
I have a venture capital fund. So there's a part of the world called private equity. So there's public equity. A lot of people might be familiar with public stocks. Like if you look at Apple or Microsoft, Walmart or whatever big public company, that's kind of called a public equity. And you can buy and sell shares of those companies as an individual retail investor in, you know, whatever country you happen to be living in. You have a few dollars sitting around. And then there's the world of private equity, where private companies manage their businesses without the scrutiny and regulation of publicly traded companies. So private companies operate with basically a lot less public oversight and government oversight. But at the same time, they really produce, I believe, the vast majority of innovation and, you know, economic sort of, you know, breakthroughs in the world. And so in the technology industry, there's a part of the private company sector called startups. And there's a lot of different definitions for the word startup and sort of what that means. But startups essentially refer to a group of people, it could be one person, building some type of technology that solves a critical problem, an interesting problem for the world, and addresses some critical pain point. Could be around automation, could be around giving people more insights into some information or data, making some business process more efficient, a lot of different things. And there's a specific type of startup that I focus on investing in. And it's a startup where the creator is focused initially on building an open source technology of some kind. And so typically it's a project that is built towards addressing some problem for developers and or is built in the open transparently and allows people to kind of see the technology in its entirety. You can read basically the entire, you know, ingredients and, you know, what's called source code around that technology. If you're interested and want to, you can actually modify and change that technology yourself. So for example, if you're a consumer of an early product that might launch on Kickstarter or maybe a big company, maybe a new Apple product or something, and you wanted to be able to contribute and change and modify that product or technology in some kind of way, it would really be either impossible or very, very difficult to do that unless that technology was open source. And so the interesting thing about the startups that I invest in through my fund, which, you know, is basically a venture capital fund, we invest money on behalf of other limited partners. It's really all of my money and also other people's money that I manage. And basically our fund makes investment decisions in early stage startups that basically fit our investment thesis. And so going back to our investment thesis, we basically identify and develop a point of view around open source technologies that we think can really be the basis for, over time, very large and impactful businesses.
So tell me about the pivotal moment that led you to start OSS Capital, that fund you were mentioning.
I was previously an entrepreneur for a number of years. I started a couple of startups that really resemble our thesis. And there were companies building a business, building a commercial opportunity for the founders and investors of those businesses, as well as the ecosystems they were operating in around some core open source technology of some kind. And so I developed a good, pretty strong understanding of this approach for, you know, a few years just as an entrepreneur. And I also got to know a bunch of people in the venture capital industry and that kind of category of, you know, asset management. And a lot of the observations that I developed around that motivated me to start OSS Capital. And so specifically, what I learned, there were a few structural things that I learned about venture capital. One of the main ones is that venture capitalists, very few of them have really clear focus mandates. In other words, you know, sort of if you were to survey maybe the top 500, maybe the top 50 venture capital funds, they really just, the extent to which you can get a sense of their focus boils down to, we like to invest in great people building great companies. And so it's really difficult to get a sense of what they actually focus on. So at least from my standpoint, that's one thing that I was always kind of confused by. The second aspect is that when you learn about open source in the context of building a product or a business, if it's like, it's really the fundamental thing, it's kind of, you're building the entire product or business around some core open source technology. What I developed as a point of view over many years from sort of working at a pretty early open source company called Talend, which was originally started in France, worked at a couple of other companies after that, that were fully proprietary software businesses. I developed a point of view, those companies were different. Kind of, they're just like a different species of company, right? They're sort of so unique on their own on a lot of different dimensions, not just one dimension, but many, many dimensions. And those observations really stuck with me. And so the combination of first noticing that there was very little focus in venture capital as an issue, and then that combined with, you know, there's really kind of two types of technology companies. There's ones that are just a fully proprietary technology behind the scenes, and you're commercializing and monetizing that somehow, as compared to a second type of company where the core technology behind the company is an open source project of some kind, as a very different kind of company. I really started to believe, and just that belief kind of continued to intensify over the years, that building commercial open source companies or open core oriented companies, and we really have to kind of invent new language to really describe why these companies are very different in many different aspects. But basically those two observations, you know, the fact that I felt, and I still really largely feel, that venture capital has very little focus. And then the second being that open source companies are really fundamentally different, and maybe they deserve their own unique kind of focused structure, really, really motivated me to start OSS Capital. I guess the third piece that gave me the confidence to do it was, I felt at the time, and maybe I feel this slightly less so now, I still probably feel this a little bit, but maybe a healthy dose, I felt extremely unqualified to try to basically solve this problem in a way that would require basically starting my own venture fund and going out and raising money from people and making investments and proving out the thesis, until I noticed that no one else was really doing it. I had sort of made some assumptions that other people might jump into this and build a fund focused exclusively on investing in open source founders. After getting to know a bunch of folks in the venture world, it quickly became apparent that that was most likely not going to happen. Not because people didn't feel like it was a good idea or not, but really that required a very, very deep amount of conviction and belief that open source companies are sort of categorically different, qualitatively different, and could actually grow into a large, meaningful category on their own over time, right? And so this is like, you know, 2017, 2018 kind of timeframe. So that's basically why I started the fund, and been a fun journey since then.
I can imagine how it's different. If you're a fund and you want to invest in IP, you don't have any IP. Not the way that people think about IP in the more traditional way. So it's of course a different focus. And I like the fact that you are really focused on something.
I think you're exactly right. It requires a change in mindset and to revisiting a lot of previous assumptions and points of view on how intellectual property works, for sure.
So tell me, what are you looking for when you first meet with startup founders?
Well, I don't meet with any startup founders, really. I mean, I focus exclusively on this world of open source technology. And it's interesting, like most of our investments, I would actually say probably 95% of our investments have been made by developing point of view first, and then secondarily developing a thesis around a project that exists in the world. And then sort of a third step, contacting the creator of the project, introducing ourselves and telling them that we really, really like what they're doing. And really, a lot of the hard work, and probably most of the hard work, is in developing conviction that the person or the people, the team behind creating the project are also the right people to start a company that can raise millions of dollars and go and potentially build a large business. And so we spend a lot of time investigating whether the creators of the project can also be potentially great founders of building a company. A lot of the time, we don't believe that that's true and we just don't invest. Sometimes when the stars align, then we invest. It's quite different from the traditional venture capital approach where you're sort of getting pitches all day and you're sitting through pitch meetings and, you know, you're taking introductions or whatever. Like, we've certainly been introduced to a handful of people and we made some investments that way. But I would say the vast majority of the time is we're really just looking at a lot of data in the open source world, developing a point of view about which markets are getting disrupted over others and which categories can be created, what points in time. We're looking at changes in the software industry, the rates of growth in different areas, like new categories that exist that didn't exist before. And we really start to kind of understand, does open source have an advantage in a particular area for whatever reason? And if it does, the really interesting thing about open source is there's so many implementations. It's kind of this Cambrian explosion of implementations and approaches that starts to happen. Once it's pretty clear something could work, you have a lot of people really trying to work on proving that out in the open source world. And so a big part of our job is really just trying to understand, from separating from all the signal and the noise, what stands out, what's actually really interesting from a growth standpoint, from engineering quality standpoint. There's a lot of things that you can determine and understand by really just looking at GitHub and looking at the data that is publicly available really to anyone. It's actually extremely fascinating doing what we do as a private seed stage venture capital investor. It has a lot of similarities to the way hedge funds manage public equity investments, at least in terms of the way they do some of the initial diligence. I would certainly say it's very different in terms of how we hold the investments. We hold them for a very long time. We're not selling and trading in and out of them like hedge funds. But the data-driven aspect is very intensely prominent in the way we actually basically develop an investment thesis and a point of view about a specific investment.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting to see that. Yeah, of course, it's built in the open, so you can do the due diligence by yourself. So how do you help those project people to go from the project to building a company?
A lot of the time, almost all the time when we lead or are the co-lead of a round, we are involved when the company is incorporated or we actually help incorporate the company. And so it's pretty much at the very earliest of the stages, like when the project is at a point where the creators have decided and they're interested in building a business around the open source technology. They appreciate that the purpose of that business is to invest and continue to grow the open source technology and just really continue to do what they've been doing. The main things that we are helpful with when we make an investment are kind of multifaceted, but I'd say the main things would be the formation of the team of the people that basically, you know, comprise the company and join the company, the formation of an understanding of a business plan and a monetization strategy, whether that's executed immediately or over time or over the course of many years. We help a lot with thinking about competitive market dynamics, understanding the broader ecosystem, understanding kind of how the ecosystem's coming together. We also, I'd say a really big part of it, a lot of people would maybe say this is the main contribution that we bring, is we really make sure that it's not only on an advisory basis, but co-investment basis, that other really great individuals who've built hugely successful open source companies from, you know, the last 15, 20, 30 years actually come along the journey with us. So it's not that we like to be alone and we don't mind being alone. And we have a lot of very high conviction in pretty much every investment that we make, but we really want to create a mechanism for doing knowledge transfer. I think we talked about this a couple of days ago, but we have this kind of network of people that join us as angel investors in rounds. A lot of them are our investors in our fund. A lot of them are just advisors to companies that we've worked with. And they're really great people. They're individuals who basically from the idea stage and as founders, really amazing companies like Red Hat, Confluent, GitHub, MongoDB, Elastic, many really great open source companies that you think of today. A lot of those people can be really valuable and helpful partners to new founders that are really just trying to figure out a lot of things that they're encountering for the first time, but other people may have already developed different points of view and have encountered in the past already. We really try to do this kind of knowledge transfer process where bringing other people on board as co-investors, as angels, and as advisors in really any kind of capacity, really just to help these founders that we work with be more successful in whatever they're dealing with, whether it's like hiring or building their community in a certain way, or even raising their next round of funding, or should they raise their next round of funding, the different points of view on different other investors, just a lot of different topics. And so those are the kinds of things that we tend to help with early on. And because the companies are so early, they're all sort of facing similar challenges around like how to manage the growth of their communities, how to make their first 5 or 10 hires, how to think about market dynamics and their business model. We tend to kind of cross-pollinate a lot of the ideas across the portfolio and also connect the founders with each other so they can kind of learn from each other as well. And it's actually reasonably easy to do that because all the companies are somewhat homogenous and similar, at least in terms of their fundamental structure. You know, they're all building companies and businesses around some core open source projects. So they tend to learn from each other pretty rapidly.
I love that idea of leveraging the power of the community to really build other companies. I like that. I read on your website that commercial open source software companies are 50% more capital efficient. Did I write that correctly? And how would you explain that?
That's something that we put up on our website. Actually, our website currently today, I think today is June 30th, 2022. I think it's the same website we've actually had on the internet since September 2018. So we're actually pushing out a brand new website pretty soon. I wouldn't say that to correct the statements on the website. I think they're all pretty accurate still. 50%, I think, is low as a rough estimate. There's a reason why I really deeply believe that open source businesses, commercial open source businesses, are more capital efficient than other types of businesses. And really, the main reason is the following. So like, if you think about a company that is building a totally proprietary product in sort of in isolation, in a cave or in a closet or whatever metaphor you want to use, and the energy required to build that product is a function of how much time and resources you need to invest in order to get that product delivered, you know, to the market or to some state where you can actually start seeing adoption. And typically, you'll really see a couple of things. Like the cost for doing that will either be subsidized by the individuals behind that technology themselves, so they'll sort of be self-funding that. It will be through other sources of financing. You might have to raise money to sort of build that initial technology and prove that out, or another company could be funding it somehow. You could be doing it nights and weekends on the side. But by the time you launch something, you've kind of typically already spent a lot of time and energy into building that out. So it really just is a lot more expensive to do that. With open source, it's very, very, very different. The open source, you have this kind of idea and you start building in the open from the beginning. A lot of projects don't quite do this, and they build in private, and they have a lot of engineering cycles invested before sort of quote unquote flipping the switch on a repository and making it public. I guess from that standpoint, you could say that they're very similar. I mean, you still have to make the investment in building out the project and building out the technology. But with open source, because you have this dynamic where the project can actually benefit from an accelerated feedback input from many more people than possible if it was built in private and it was sort of a closed beta and you had a wait list or whatever, it just makes the product and the technology better at a faster rate. And as a consequence, it reduces the cost to bring the technology to a state of stability and maturity and development velocity, really, that would otherwise be possible with a proprietary approach. And so as a result, by the time that we invest in a company around an open source technology, most of the cases show that the project already has a sort of an equivalent amount of adoption, testing, QA, development, and really contribution from a lot of people that otherwise you'd have to kind of raise many millions of dollars to produce if you were building a fully proprietary technology company. And that's just on the research and development sort of core technology side of things. If you look at customer acquisition and revenue and building a business, a lot of the things that we've seen as well are that capital efficiencies are even greater in that area. So with open source projects, you have this developer community that could use the technology in a lot of different ways, in many different flexible contexts and lots of use cases they could be building out. And by the time you sort of navigate to a buyer, inside of maybe an enterprise organization, an IT or a line of business or a CTO organization, what have you, a lot of the time they might actually already be users of your technology and they might already be advocates. And they could, in fact, they could just survey their developer community and sort of recognize, wow, we're actually already using your technology and everyone loves it. So by the time that we want to start negotiating a contract or understand what your product or your service is, we're already sold. Like there's no need to sell us. And at that point, it starts to become much easier and the friction starts to drop dramatically for the startup or for the company that wants to sell something to really sell that thing efficiently and sell it with the least amount of friction possible. And so instead of sort of the old way of selling software, this is actually not necessarily the old way. I think this is actually largely still how it works in sort of proprietary SaaS world, is a lot of customer acquisition dollars spent to just get in front of the customer and get users and get adoption. And then you have another big wave of dollars spent to convert those users into paying customers. And so that's why I think we have in this kind of SaaS category, we have all these terms like viral coefficients and all the conversion rate heuristics, all these different things that are really optimized around, okay, you've spent a certain amount of dollars to just get the adoption wheel flywheel going. And then you have another amount of dollars that you spend to figure out how to convert those users. And I'm not saying all those things go away completely. Obviously, you still have to invest time and energy in sort of navigating how to convert all of your adoption into a business of some kind, fractionally or marginally speaking. But with open source as a sort of phenomena that helps not just with distribution and marketing, it also helps with quality of the product, innovation rate of the product, trust of the product, and so many other things. I believe the 50% capital efficiency percentage that you're pointing to on the website there is pretty low. And in fact, I think that the percentage amount was actually referring to something a little bit more specific. And so I can kind of explain what it is in like 30 seconds or so, but it's basically pointing to there's a cohort of open source businesses in the last kind of 15 years that reached 100 million or more in revenue. What I was referring to in that percentage was that on average, those businesses went out and raised, I believe, about $250 million to reach that level of revenue, meaning that they went out and raised a seed round, a series A, a series B, a series C, and in some cases, a series D to reach a 100 million revenue business. And I would argue, this is a long-running hypothesis that we're actively testing with OSS Capital, and hopefully we'll see what the data looks like in the next, you know, maybe 5 years or something. I would argue that in all, not some, all of those cases, those companies raised too much money that they did not need to raise in order to reach the same outcomes and the same revenue milestones in fact, the same amount of time. As a result, you know, you can say those companies were overfunded or they raised money unnecessarily, however you want to express that. But that's basically part of our mission with OSS Capital, is to change a few things about the way open source businesses are built so that they can be better understood from a fundamental standpoint and basically run more capital efficiently.
So based on all that, we can expect that we will have more people creating open source software in the future, right? Do you see that really growing?
Well, this is an interesting question. There's a lot of research and reports that I can point to, maybe you can include them in the show notes, that show the rate of open source. Some people point to it as declining. Some people point to it as growing. I tend to be very biased in thinking that the rate of open source is only expanding and growing. One proxy for that would be looking at GitHub's data. So, you know, they're going to reach something like 100 million registered users pretty soon. I think when Microsoft acquired GitHub in 2018, they were around 20 million or 30 million users. So they've grown quite a lot over the last few years. It's not to say that every registered account on GitHub is someone creating open source. I don't think that that's true. It's probably a fraction of that 100 million that we're about to see on GitHub actually creating open source projects. But one thing that I do think is true at a broader sense is I think more humans are becoming aware of the fact that sort of the highest leverage and the most impactful professional career that you can pursue is in software development, software engineering, and more specifically building software products. And I believe that building software products will over time become more and more automated and humans will need to learn fewer technologies and fewer languages to build complex, innovative products. But I do not subscribe to the point of view that the AI is going to be writing all the code for us. I do not believe that is true. And so I think more people, more humans will need to learn how to program and write code for computers, because with the way computers are currently built, we need to express very precise instructions to that computer in order for the computer to do what we want it to do. I don't believe that the AI models today can generate the level of precision and nuance needed to build complex software products that do, you know, very arbitrarily complex things for humans, whether it's infrastructure software, database software, application software, what have you. There are too many wide encompassing aspects of the technology stack that need to be fine-tuned and tweaked and implemented using code and software largely stitched together, managed, or written by hand via humans. And so as a result, I can only be most confident in the fact that as the software and that sort of this digital technology career starts to become more compelling and interesting to more people, because this is just really where the highest leverage and the highest compensation exists in the tech industry, more people will realize in order to be the most differentiated, you have to learn how computers speak. As a result, you have to learn how to program. And I think as that happens, if you look at all of the software engineers today, all the professional software engineers, however many there are, it's, you know, there's a lot of debate we can do around this, but like, I think largely speaking, most people would agree there's somewhere on the order of 20 or 30 million software engineers in the world, like professional software engineers. Some people say 50 million. So let's say it's somewhere between 30 and 50 million. I would argue, and I think most people would agree, that 99.9% of all of those software engineers heavily, heavily depend on open source. It's not a question of how much they depend on open source. It's really they fundamentally depend on open source, right? Like without open source technology and tools and infrastructure, they would not be able to do their jobs, period. Like they would not be productive. Like imagine as a developer that you went to your computer and, you know, instead of using millions of projects that exist that you can readily access on the internet for free and pull together in your application to be productive and build something for the world, you had to write your own custom compiler from scratch. You had to write your own programming language from scratch. You had to write your own application server from scratch. You had to write your own development framework from scratch. You know, you had to write your own networking stack from scratch and your own database runtime from scratch and a long list of things. You would never get anything done. It would take you decades of your life to get anything done if you were very talented in the modern world. And so I think there's this leverage that exists with open source that is unquantifiable and immeasurable. And as a result, software engineers really greatly appreciate that. And they continue to participate in that movement. This is an interesting phenomenon that non-technical people, people who do not code or do not understand how computers work, they just don't understand how it works. A lot of time when I'm talking to our investors who, in a lot of cases, are non-technical institutions or other individuals, they're not familiar with open source. They'll often ask this question, why is it that humans continue to invest so much of their time in this open source thing when they're not getting paid and they don't have any economic benefit? And it's kind of interesting that people ask this question, because it's very revealing of the lack of appreciation for how much benefit and leverage engineers get from helping other engineers. There's this really interesting tribal aspect where engineers are very motivated to help other engineers. And the way that they do that most efficiently and effectively is by contributing to open source and sharing their project and sharing their insights with others. And that just perpetuates the growth of this community. And so I think as more people come into the tech industry and appreciate that software engineering is the highest leverage discipline, and then they become software engineers, they realize that the only way they can continue to benefit from, you know, all the things that come with that is to really contribute to open source and to, you know, to give back to that community. I think that that just continues to expand the flywheel of open source, and it continues to accelerate the fundamentals. I think another aspect that people don't really appreciate is there's really two types of motivations in the world. There's motivation to do something for an extrinsic reward, sort of like an extrinsic motivation. I'm doing something to get paid, some monetary or some measurable reward. or you're doing something intrinsically. You have this intrinsic motivation. You're doing it out of the goodness of your heart, or, you know, in order to learn something new or to have a good feeling about participating in some positive system. And that's really what open source is all about. People do it for the intrinsic reason that helping others sort of overrides all the other motivations. And they want to do that specifically because they've benefited from all this infrastructure that already exists. And so I think it's kind of a counterintuitive thing. It's a little bit difficult for non-technical people to understand, but I think it's pretty profound. And I believe that that's the kind of the main reason open source will continue to grow and be a huge force over time in the future. And actually, furthermore, I have a much more kind of aggressive point of view around this, which is that I think open source will not only just continue its current pace, but as people realize more how powerful this approach is to building technology, I think that we're going to see open source disrupt and transform pretty much every category in the, at a minimum, the digital technology world, which is all of software, all of consumer applications, you know, pretty much anything digital that you can imagine.
This is really impactful. And speaking about intrinsic motivation, yeah, changing the world is a good one, I believe. I love it. Joseph, you worked with a lot of leaders. Among those who you admire, what's the one trait that stands out to you?
I would say the main trait that stands out to me is humility. People who have accomplished a lot and are extremely successful at what they do tend to have humility. And it's one thing that I've noticed and that has really stood out to me and something that I'm still personally working on. I can definitely have a lot of arrogance and hubris at a lot of times. And so developing humility, I think is a really important attribute that I really admire. And it's actually something that is easy to forget. Like when you're really trying to identify the absolute best people in whatever area that you're looking into, and you're trying to find the best insights and the most skilled people who have just a level of depth that is hard to express because it's kind of experiential, or some individual has accomplished, you know, some massive outcome or built something really huge. I would say the vast majority of the time, people who have accomplished really huge things, if you really sit down with them and get to know them, they're very humble. And in fact, they're so humble that they sort of look back at everything that they've built. They almost think very little of it. They sort of think, you know, I learned a lot from that, but I don't think that that's what defines me as a human. It's an interesting quality that I appreciate a lot, probably the main quality. The reason I'm so interested in this is I'd say there's some leaders who don't have that quality where they may actually be very accomplished and may be extremely good at what they do. Those leaders may be very accomplished, but they don't have the humility that comes with a level of self-awareness that becomes very valuable in conversations when, you know, you're partnering with them or you're collaborating with them or you're trying to solve a problem. That's probably the number one thing that I pay attention to these days.
Really, really beautiful and inspiring. Thank you very much, Joseph, for having joined the podcast today.
Thank you, Alexis, for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Le Podcast. Go to alexis.monville.com for the references mentioned in the episode and to find more help to increase your impact and satisfaction at work. Drop a comment or an email with your feedback or just to say hello. And until next time, to find better ways of changing your team.